Hello, this is your Polycast for Tuesday, April 5th, your daily check-in on Minnesota politics. I'm Mike Mulcahy in the Minnesota Public Radio newsroom. On today's edition, a call for a new investigation of the Jamar Clark shooting and the debate over too big to fail. The head of the Minneapolis NAACP is calling on authorities to reopen the Jamar Clark police shooting case and appoint a special prosecutor to lead the investigation. The demand for a new probe yesterday came as a woman previously identified as Clark's girlfriend gave a different account of what led up to the fatal police shooting in November. Tawali Saikautau reports.
Speaking publicly for the first time, North Minneapolis resident Rayanne Hayes told reporters that her 9/11 call for an ambulance on November 15th had nothing to do with a domestic violence situation.
The night in question happened. I never got beaten. I never called the police and said I was beaten by my boyfriend. I don't even know where that story came from.
Hayes says she was intoxicated at a birthday party when another couple started fighting, and she and her friend, Jamar Clark, tried to break it up.
Jamar tried to stop it, and I pulled away from him. I fell, and I twisted my ankle. I called 2 hours later. I said it wasn't an emergency. I said, I think I hurt my ankle.
After she spoke, Tito Wilson, the owner of a barbershop near where Jamar Clark was shot, gave his account of that night, a version that differs greatly from the police.
I couldn't determine if there was any handcuffs there, but what I could determine is that they had Jamar on the ground, thoroughly pinned down. He was not fighting. He wasn't, like, doing all these weird movements, trying to get a gun. That's the story that they put out, but it's not true.
Police said Jamar Clark resisted arrest and failed to take his hands out of his pockets. Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman said Clark's DNA was found on the officer's holster and belt, and he announced last week that he would not prosecute the two officers involved.
As an attorney, I found the statements by Mike Freeman claiming that DNA evidence is a truth serum to really be laughable.
That's Nikema Levy-Pounds, president of the Minneapolis chapter of the NAACP.
We are tired of people being killed and harassed and overcriminalized at the hands of the police. And I hope people understand that this is a part of a pattern here. It's a part of a pattern where officers are not indicted when they kill unarmed people in the state of Minnesota. And that is just like what's happening around the country, contrary to Mike Freeman claiming that this case is different.
In a statement, Freeman said paramedics who responded to the 9/11 call said Rayanne Hayes identified Jamar Clark as her assailant, saying, quote, "The female, our patient, says that's the guy who did this. He did this to me." The statement also said some witnesses who knew both Hayes and Clark characterized their relationship as a romantic one. Freeman said he's convinced that if people read the entire record available online, they will agree that no charges can be brought against the police officers. Dwahli Saikautau, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
In the 4 weeks since the 2016 legislative session began, there have been more than 1,400 bills introduced in the Minnesota House and 1,200 in the Senate. Few of them will go the distance and become law. Many had no shot from the start. But as Brian Baxter reports, getting a bill passed isn't always the only goal.
Okay, we want to thank you for coming. And we are here to discuss House
Republican Representative Glenn Grunhagen held a press conference recently to talk about a bill he was introducing.
And people do have rights on both sides of this issue.
Even before he had the chance to describe his legislation placing gender-specific restrictions on public restrooms, DFL Governor Mark Dayton had reached his conclusion on the bill. He vowed a veto.
This is about pandering to their extreme base. And they're wrong on the issue and they're wrong on the morality of it.
Dayton has also issued a veto threat this year on a bill revoking funding for clinics that provide abortions. In similar fashion, a Democratic proposal allowing doctors to prescribe medication to let terminally ill patients end their life made its initial splash and its exit on the same day without a vote. It had no chance in the Republican-led House. So why bother? Legislation that has little chance of passing can still play a powerful role in firing up certain groups of voters. It can put the opposition party on the spot, it can become a chip to trade away later, or it can lay the groundwork for future, more successful consideration. Former Democratic Senate Majority Leader Roger Moe says the no-hope bills tend to be more prevalent when legislators are gearing up for re-election runs.
This being an election year, there's going to be Some of these bills are introduced purely for the sheer politics of it all, in some cases to get the opponent on a vote, and in some cases just to kind of play to your respective bases, whichever they may be on the right or on the left.
Seldom will lawmakers admit they don't stand a chance, and any of the 201 legislators can introduce any measure. That can mean heartburn for caucus leaders who pride themselves on crafting disciplined messages and neatly tailored agendas. Sometimes they're able to tell members to back down. But as former Republican House Speaker Kurt Zellers knows too well, that's not always successful.
A lot of times a leader can give good advice to a member. They can suggest the circumstances that are before them, what the outcome is going to be, and sometimes they just can't help themselves. They're going to push that bill. They're going to bring it forward. And even if in some cases it causes harm to other members of their, you know, Republican or Democrat side, because people look at it and go, well, that's a waste of time. Why would you do something like that? They're still going
to
do it.
That's not to say that every plan with a bleak outlook is equal. Take the bill in the House to reroute women's health grants and make abortion providers like Planned Parenthood ineligible. It has advanced despite Dayton's veto threat, which he delivered in a sharply worded letter to the bill's author last week. Republican Representative Kathy Lohmer of Lake Elmo says she won't be dissuaded.
Do things that I think are the right things to do. I try not to be political. I just try to do what I think is right. So to me, this is the right thing to do.
And if it stays on its current track, her proposal could be a point of contention when Dayton engages leaders of the Democratic Senate and Republican House in end-of-session negotiations. It could get linked to a budget bill expected to be a focal point of those talks. Likewise, a priority DFL plan establishing paid family leave policies for most Minnesota workers faces an uphill climb on the House side. That ambitious proposal has already been scaled back to keep it afloat in the Senate. Democrats have signaled it will be among the topics they'll hit in the fall campaign, too. Lead sponsor Katie Sieben of Newport isn't giving in yet.
Well, I hope it will happen this year, and I think that the overwhelming public support for the bill will help push the House ultimately to do something in the end of the session.
And as Zellers remembers, such strategic positioning is always part of the calculation.
Gets brought up because it's going to be a part of those final negotiations. Well, we gave up on our single most popular issue. Now you have to give up on your issue.
That stockpiling of proposals for late session bargaining is in full swing. And even those eventually cast aside are sure to be fodder in the campaigns for House and Senate control this November. Covering politics, I'm Brian Baxt, Minnesota Public Radio News.
A Minnesota banking official continues to stir debate about whether banks have grown too large. Minneapolis Fed President Neil Kashkari believes not enough has been done to protect the country should one or more of the nation's mega banks face failure. But there was no consensus at a conference yesterday about what should be done or even that banks are too big. Martin Moylan has more.
Neil Kashkari argues banks that were too big for regulators to let fail in the past have only grown bigger. But in convening economists and regulators in Minneapolis to mull what should be done about big banks, the Minneapolis Federal Reserve president intentionally invited people with divergent views. There's still disagreement over how much banks should be allowed to risk and whether laws already in place are enough to prevent another crisis that took down the economy in 2008. Proposed fixes yesterday included requiring bank owners to put more of their own money at risk, keeping more money in reserve should a bank run into trouble. Stanford University economist Anat Admarty was in that camp.
We subsidize recklessness in banking.
Several experts said some banks are simply too big to be allowed to fail and should be downsized. The banks of particular concern were those with more than $1 trillion in assets: JPMorgan Chase, Bank of America, Citibank, and Wells Fargo. MIT professor Simon Johnson said the damage that could be caused by the failure of mega banks would be catastrophic.
If the Federal Reserve allows this financial system to continue in its current form, you're putting the economy in jeopardy, you're putting the financial system in jeopardy, and you're putting yourself, the Federal Reserve system, directly in the line of political fire next time.
But other economists and experts had different views. University of California at Berkeley professor Ross Levine said breaking up the biggest banks could backfire.
Breaking up the big banks might hurt the services that are provided by banks, whether it's economies of scale or economies of scope.
Another argument, shrinking U.S. megabanks could hurt U.S. multinationals like Minnesota-based 3M, which does most of its business overseas. Here's economist Aaron Klein from the Brookings Institution.
What are the ramifications for global businesses with no large U.S. banks? One, they use a lot of small banks, probably more costly. So if you want to drive down 3M profits and up profits to the agglomerated banking industry, that would be a ramification. I'm kind of against that.
Kashkari said he invited representatives of big banks, but none chose to attend.
Instead, they're writing op-eds and editorials saying that their voices aren't being heard or they aren't part of the process. Well, they're not part of the process because they declined to be part of the process. I'm glad they're taking this as seriously as they are. It means that they're scared.
Kashkari plans additional forums on the too-big-to-fail issue for later this year. The former head of the bank bailout program in 2008 says the Minneapolis Fed will draft a proposed plan of action, but it'll be up to the public and Congress to decide if it makes sense to execute. Martin Moylan, Minnesota Public Radio News.
And that's your Polycast for this Tuesday, your daily check-in on Minnesota politics. I'm Mike Mulcahy in the Minnesota Public Radio Newsroom.